Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Maggie Quinn, assistant producer in VOA's English division. Our guest on this edition of the program is Yochi Driesen, respected military journalist and author of the recently published book, The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War. Yochi Driesen is also the managing editor of Foreign Policy, a publication that delivers credible news in international politics and global affairs. Driesen has covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for the Wall Street Journal and has reported for more than 20 countries. The Invisible Front, which is Driesen's first book, tells the story of a military family that lost two sons, one to suicide and one in combat, and channeled their grief into fighting the military's suicide epidemic. Yochi Driesen uses the Graham family's work as a new way of understanding the human cost of America's two longest wars and the invisible wounds soldiers can suffer, both on and off the battlefield. We'll talk with Yochi about his new book and about the barriers within the U.S. military and U.S. society in general that prevent troubled soldiers from seeking help for depression or PTSD, known as post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as the culture of stigma that perpetuates this trend. We'll also gain his insight about future actions that must take place in order to confront these issues head-on and ultimately support U.S. servicemen and women on and off the battlefield before and after their deployment. Yochi Driesen joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Maggie Quinn.
Thank you, Carol.
Yochi, congratulations on this terrific book.
Thank you.
It's both very engrossing, but also very disturbing, talking about this epidemic of suicide in this country, particularly among the military. Now, you've been covering the military for over 15 years. What prompted you to write the book about this rate of suicide in the U.S. military and to do so through the lens of the Graham family?
In 2009, I came back basically to live in the U.S. after spending a little bit over 4 years either living in Iraq or Afghanistan or traveling to and from. I had a lot of friends who were in the military, people I'd spent time with in the two war zones, and I began to hear from them about their own issues, their own alcoholism, their anger, their inability to sleep. A few of them talked of suicide, and a few of them committed suicide. And when I was at the Pentagon, I would mention to friends there, friends so-and-so had just killed himself, or friends so-and-so had mentioned that they were depressed. Do you know anybody in the military who's aware of this, who's fighting this? And I kept hearing the name Mark Graham. And when people would say his name, they would say, he's a general who lost two sons. You should go meet him. I had a hard time believing at first that a man could lose two sons and still live. He did. I spent time with him, and he became the centerpiece of the story because he's an extraordinarily brave and strong man.
Well, we want to talk more about the Graham family's predicament. But before we do that, talk a bit about PTSD. We know the phenomenon really goes back to World War II, of course, Vietnam. We saw it more visibly, and now with the two wars, both Afghanistan and Iraq. Talk about how it's different today.
When we think about PTSD, which is now a term that most people know of, the kind of issues it talks about, these go back for as long as humans have picked up weapons against each other. What's happening now is that you have people going not once to a war zone, but two times, three times, four times, five times. They're seeing civilians get killed. They themselves may be killing civilians. So an issue that's always existed, that's always been there, shadowing war for as long as people have committed war, has gotten worse.
Let me turn to Maggie for a question.
Can you explain what kind of mental health screening the military does currently to test for pre-existing mental health disorders, and also the rules and regulations of enlisting with a mental health disorder?
So those are both very good questions. The thing that the military focuses on now more than it focuses on directly looking, let's say, for signs of depression, mm-hmm. are signs of alcoholism or propensity for alcoholism or signs of drug abuse. Because what they're finding is that in almost every case of military suicide, there's some issue involving alcohol or involving drugs. So their main focus is trying to spot the people who may be alcoholic or may be prone to drug addiction more than it is trying to find people who may be prone to depression or to PTSD.
Well, that leads me to ask you another question about the Graham family, Yochi, and particularly about Kevin. He was the younger son. that took his own life. He was concerned about the need for him to take medication for his depression, and that if the army found out, he would not be able to go into the military. Is that still the case right now? If one is on that medication and they're stabilized, but that is a stigma that prevents them from joining the military?
The military has gotten a bit better and a bit looser about allowing people in who may have these types of issues. For a long time, for instance, if you applied for a security clearance, which you would need not just in the military, but if you wanted to join the CIA, if you wanted to join the FBI, you had to disclose on that form if you'd ever gotten therapy or taken medication. And what that meant was people, of course, said, I didn't ever get therapy. I didn't take medication, because if they did, they'd lose their clearance. That was changed, so now you can admit that openly, but it took 3 years of fighting within the U.S. government to make a change. With Kevin Graham, who had been always the sort of perfect child, this perfect soldier to be, his feeling, and at the time he was correct, was his career would end before it started, that if people found out he was taking it, they would kick him out. One quick point, when we talk about medication, there's sort of two issues. The one issue is, are there formal rules in black and white? And the other issue is cultural.
Mm-hmm.
And the cultural issue is huge.
Right. Exactly. I'd like you to talk about the cultural issue, because I found some interesting contradictions when you were writing about the Graham family. For example, Carol, the mother, and the father, who was already in the military, Mark, allowed their children to drink, to sort of abuse alcohol openly. But in this case, Kevin was afraid to admit that he needed depression medication. This is what I found a bit astounding, that in our culture, somehow it's okay to go on binge drinking. And somehow what people are most concerned about is somebody admitting that they have some sort of depression or mood disorder. In your, you know, talks with the family, did they admit that this was something that they had regretted? Because Carol herself had a history of depression in her family. So it wouldn't be, in any way surprising that her son would be suffering from that.
So Carol had in her family a long history of mental illness, and Mark did too. There were suicides, there was alcoholism. The family could just tell there was something wrong with them, even though it was an era where that wasn't diagnosed or treated. So on both sides, there was a history of this. And until the day they die, Mark and Carol will always blame themselves and say, if only we had seen this sign, if only we had seen that sign. They will never forgive themselves for it. And Carol, in researching the book, what I found is, when I mention to a person who I just meet in a bookstore or in a library, almost everyone says to me that they know someone for whom this was an issue. Maybe in their family, in some cases they say they themselves fought this. I think where we are now is where alcohol abuse was 50 years ago. Everyone knows it's there. But as you say, we're not yet at a point where people feel comfortable talking about it openly.
Question from Maggie.
Yeah, so with our move to have a more growing awareness and make this an open conversation, and you know, your book's called to bring attention to the suicide epidemic, is there fear that with more awareness, people will be maybe dissuaded from enlisting in the military now that they, you know, hear that there's very high rates of suicide and that PTSD is maybe almost expected?
To your second point, I spoke to someone for the book who made the point that if you go to war and you see the horrors of war and you hear the sounds of it, you smell the parts of it, and you come back and you haven't changed, that's when something is wrong with you.
Right.
That war should change you. And if you come back exactly the same as when you left, there's something profoundly, profoundly wrong with you. And I think he's exactly right. I think there are people for whom joining the military, when they know the possibility of the psychological wound, the emotional wound, it will be a bit of something that dissuades them. On the other, the military is mostly men between 18 and 25. And men between 18 and 25 just don't think of something happening to them. They think, I'm tough, I'm strong, I'll get through this without a physical wound, and I'll get through this without an emotional wound.
Yochi, what do you think are the specific factors within the U.S. military and U.S. society in general, which have contributed to this culture of stigma within the military that prevents troubled soldiers from seeking help?
Stigma is a term that has a sort of clinical coldness to it. It's easy to hear and then not really understand exactly what it means. And when we talk about stigma in the military, we talk about the fact that a lot of soldiers are afraid that if they seek help and their other soldiers in their unit find out, they'll be mocked. They'll be either literally kicked out of the unit or ostracized. And changing that culture, which exists because for so long, soldiers have said, I'm tough enough to get through anything. I'm not someone who's going to go cry. I'm not a civilian, which was always a kind of way of, in the military, putting a person down. So if they hear of a soldier who's crying at night because of what he saw, who can't sleep because of his nightmares, their inclination is to say, that soldier is weak. And this comes to, how do you change a culture where that has existed for decades.
Well, we'll get more into how that may or may not be changing in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Yochi Driesen. He's managing editor of Foreign Policy and author of an important new book, The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Maggie Quinn. She's assistant producer in VOA's English division. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Also, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback on guests and topics to PCUSA@voanews.com. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Abdi Fattah Ahmed. Well, Yochi, back to changing this so-called culture within the military, what you described as a macho, chauvinistic culture. Do you see any changes, perhaps as a result of Mark Graham, the protagonist in the book, of things he did in the aftermath of the death of his two sons?
What you're beginning to see are people at the highest levels of the Pentagon talking about these issues, which is important. For a long time, the military said, we don't have a suicide problem. They said, if you look at our demographics and the civilian world, men between 18 and 25, our rate is lower. That was true until 2009, which is when I met Mark Graham. That was the first year where the military rate, even adjusted, was higher than the rate in the civilian world. And just to put a number to it, especially for people who are listening to this outside the United States, so Afghanistan is the longest war in the history of the United States, but more soldiers have killed themselves since 2001 than died in Afghanistan. And the suicide numbers are growing. There have been very few American deaths in Afghanistan this year. There have been more than 320 suicides this year, and there's very little sign of it ending. One thing that President Obama has done, to his credit, is that for the first time, soldiers who kill themselves get condolence letters from the White House. That had never existed before. It was hugely controversial because you had many in the military say, I don't care if this kid had PTSD, he shot himself in the head. That is different than being shot in the head by someone in the Taliban. It was and remains controversial, but President Obama personally has now changed that policy.
Do you have another question, Maggie?
Yeah. So going back to, you know, we're talking about this whole stigma and soldiers feeling like they have to maintain a front and be able to deal with a lot of things. I mean, I imagine that in some ways, soldiers have to be trained to suppress some of their physical and emotional responses because you have to do, you know, some pretty tough things while you're in war. So how do you balance that with also telling soldiers that it's normal for them to suffer from PTSD or depression, and then also teach them how to recognize the signs and seek help?
So the military now is trying to use something called resiliency training. And the idea there is to give a soldier, before he deploys, some sense of what he might see. But the notion is to say to him or her, when you go, this is what you might see. And after you see it, this is how you might react. And if you have trouble sleeping, if you have trouble looking at a person without feeling anger, that's not a flaw in you. That you are not sick, that you are not damaged, but that's normal.
Do you also see then, Yochi, that more and more servicemen and women who acknowledge their post-traumatic stress disorder or depression or whatever as a result of combat, when they seek help for it, is that seen more and more as a sign of strength than a sign of weakness, which is up until now how it's been seen?
Unfortunately, it's not yet seen as a sign of strength. It's somewhere between the two. It's seen now as slightly more normal, slightly more acceptable, which is a huge improvement, but it is not yet seen as a sign of strength. There's a Medal of Honor winner, a person who won the highest commendation you could win in the U.S. military, named Ty Carter. And when Ty Carter, a hero by every definition of the phrase as the military uses it, whenever he speaks, he uses that exact phrase, that seeking help is a sign of strength. It's beginning to percolate through, it's beginning to permeate. It hasn't yet, but thankfully there are some signs of progress that's becoming more the norm.
And in your opinion, what do you think are among the most important things that the military can do to help bring down the rate of suicide?
We think of the military as the literal definition of a hierarchy, that you have the soldiers at the very bottom and you have the generals at the very top. And until the generals at the very top, or the senior enlisted people, so the people who are not officers but have spent decades in the military, until they start to say, I, General Driesen, had PTSD, I, General Driesen, felt suicidal, but I came through it. I was able to have a long, healthy, successful career in the military. Until that happens, the culture won't change. And, you know, Carol, when I was researching the book, I spoke to an array of generals who I knew from either Iraq or Afghanistan. And when we were talking, they would say, I have trouble sleeping. I have anger. My wife said to me, hey, you're not the same as when you came back. They didn't use the term PTSD, because that's a loaded term, but what they described was PTSD. And I said to them, telling that story would do good. Telling that story would have a message for young soldiers that would be valuable. None of them would let me tell their story. Even at the absolute pinnacle of their career, where stigma doesn't exist, it's not like they could have their career end, still, they would not let me tell their story.
Well, they wouldn't let you tell their story, but do we have any evidence that the most senior military leaders are acknowledging that this has to be done? Do you hear the Joint Chiefs of Staff or anyone else in any of the services acknowledging that senior officers need to speak out? And if they say that they need to speak out about this, perhaps, you know, they will.
One of the people I interviewed for the book was Admiral Mike Mullen, who had been the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, very well respected in the military. And for the book, he told me exactly that. He said, we do need senior officers to tell their own story. We do need senior officers to be public and to speak personally about what they went through. In all the research I did for the book, I found total 4 generals who were willing to talk about it, one who's quoted in the book, a few who are not. But you're talking about dozens of generals who have served in one of the 2 war zones or both, 4 of them willing to talk about it. So at the senior levels, there are people saying, we need this. But in terms of people actually doing it, you're not yet seeing it happen.
Now, Mark Graham, in the book, made a number of changes as a result of his losses of his 2 sons. Talk about some of the most salient reforms that Mark Graham was able to institute that can help prevent this rate of suicide and remove the stigma associated with men and women who grapple with depression and PTSD.
So Mark Graham became a 2-star general and took command of a base in Colorado called Fort Carson, one of the biggest bases in the entire U.S. military. When he got there, it had one of the highest suicide rates across the Army. It also had a large murder streak, which was itself a different horror. When Mark got there, there were 3 things he did that had tremendous impact. The first was he would openly talk about his own emotional issues. He would cry in front of other soldiers. No general had ever done that. The second thing he did was put in place a hotline where if you, let's say, were worried about your husband or a male soldier was worried about his wife who was also a soldier, they could call and have that call go directly to Mark, who's able to help. So if a general hears about a case and wants to get that person into treatment, they can do it. The third thing, which was the most important by far, and has been replicated across the entire U.S. military, was to create a team of psychologists who'd be assigned to a single unit. They would speak to them before they left. They would speak to them while they were in the war zone. They'd speak to them when they got back. What that did was, for a soldier who came back from war and might be sitting across from someone they'd never met before, a civilian, and not trust that person could possibly understand what they had gone through, this was no longer a stranger they were talking to. This was someone who knew them and who they knew.
Now, you also say in the book that many of the suicides could have been prevented if some of the senior commanders had monitored the emotional state of their troops and had done more to ensure that those who needed assistance got it before they harmed themselves or others. Do you see any evidence that the military is prepared to hold officers and enlisted personnel responsible for failing to act?
Unfortunately, no. You see the military trying. It's a giant bureaucracy. It's like this giant sort of glacier trying to turn. So, for instance, there's one day where the entire military stops what it's doing to talk about mental health. So there are things that they are trying to do, and that's very much to their credit. But what you are not yet seeing is a case where there was a suicide in a unit, or 2 or 3, and that officer was fired, or the top enlisted soldier whose job was to look for morale was fired. You see something, Carol, similar to that with sexual assault. There was a hearing in the United States Senate a few months back where a senator from New York said to the assembled Joint Chiefs of Staff, so the most powerful men in the U.S. military, and said to them, can you point to any commander who was relieved because of how sexual assault, how rape was handled in their unit? And it was quiet, quiet, quiet. Ultimately, 2 of them could each point to 1 case, but we're talking about an epidemic of sexual assault rivaling an epidemic of suicide where people were not held responsible. And until they are, if you're an officer, you will care about this deeply. Most officers are profoundly compassionate, but you won't see it as something where your career depends on how you handle it.
Yoki, going back to your talk about how a lot of senior officers haven't spoken up about them suffering from any of these problems, and also that a lot of times they aren't held accountable if they're not, you know, calling out issues with their soldiers and things like that. Do you feel confident about this maybe changing on a generational level? I'm thinking college campuses now, you have people who stand up against suicide, you have all these student orgs, you have commercials that openly talk about drugs that are used. Do you see maybe the soldiers who are 18 to 25 now, when they reach the senior officer position, this being something that will hopefully change?
I think that it's a very good point, and I think it's a very good question. there's certainly a hope that when you grow up and you see commercials for Zoloft or Xanax or any of the commercials you see on American television, that you do have a comfort level because it's something that it is discussed. But there's a generational issue that pushes the other direction, which is kind of depressing. Right. We can often think of the military as distinct from the country, that it's its own world, and that the civilian world is a different world altogether. But the one reflects the other. The military comes from the civilian world, and the issues that affect one impact the other. From the creation of the automobile till today, car crashes were the leading cause of death other than illness. Now, more people kill themselves, civilians, than die in car crashes. That had always been the case, the high number of suicides in the civilian world among high school kids who are bullied, or college kids who were raped or feel like they're failing their parents. What you're seeing now, and this is why I mention it as a generational issue, is that men between 50 and 65 are now killing themselves in huge numbers. And the reason is economic, for the most part. These are men who may have been laid off. They think correctly, unfortunately, that they will probably never find a job. And so they decide, I can't live like this. I'm a burden to my family. I'm going to kill myself. So there's a generational issue, which is positive, potentially, of soldiers talking about it. There's a generational issue, which is negative, of suicide spreading from the young, where it had always been, to the old, where it had not.
And of course, there are many larger issues. The wars that we're fighting now, many allege that the Iraq war in 2003 was prosecuted on false premises. So we're in wars, endless wars, as you say, in the title of your book. This is demoralizing in general. And people wonder, you know, what are we fighting for? So this probably has to impact on the morale.
It does. And when we think about warfare, there's a lot of talk about how drone warfare, that's the future. And American pilots aren't in danger. There are no American ground troops who are at risk. Drone operators, the people who fly these from bases in Nevada, in Iraq, Afghanistan, they suffer PTSD too. So we can think that we don't have 20,000 or 100,000 ground troops invading Iraq and may not again. But the people who are flying the weapons of the future are also suffering PTSD. This is not something, unfortunately, where because you may not be picking up a gun yourself, running onto a battlefield, that you're immune. In a very weird way, in the case of a drone operator, it's because of their proximity. The cameras are so high definition that it's almost as if you're watching television, where you're seeing it in HD, and you're seeing the person you've been tracking for a few days. You press a button, explosion, that person is dead. Your PTSD comes from that, mm-hmm. And it could be just as high and just as severe.
Yochi, what happens to the standing of a respected career soldier who develops PTSD? Can he or she keep serving, and can they keep their benefits?
Yes, they can keep serving, provided that there's no disciplinary issue, there's nothing that they've done wrong, they'll stay in and get their benefits. The question, though, is will they get promoted, or does their career stop? And that's hard. It's hard to know when a person isn't promoted. Was it because they admitted to having PTSD? Mark Graham was a 2-star general, widely respected across the military. He did not get promoted. He did not get his 3rd star. And when you talk to him, he will say, it had nothing to do with my work on suicide. There are a small number of slots. I just didn't make it. I mean, he is a very humble man with a tremendous integrity. When you talk to those around him, his friends, his admirers, they'll say, it's because he talked too much about PTSD. It's because he talked too much about suicide. If he'd kept his head down, he would have gotten a 3rd star. So in some ways, the question, to my mind, is less, will you be kicked out? And more, will you ascend up? And right now, there are many signs that if you speak up too loudly, your career will end because you don't get promoted up higher.
That's a very interesting and unfortunate phenomenon, but hopefully in time this may change as well. The last question regarding the Veterans Administration. To what extent is the Veterans Administration also responsible for this epidemic of suicides and inadequate treatment of PTSD? What is the relationship between that bureaucracy and the armed forces in terms of treating our servicemen and women returning from combat?
Unfortunately, the same issues that prevent somebody who has a physical wound from getting help, those same issues prevent somebody who has an invisible wound from seeking help. There are not enough doctors. There are not enough nurses. There are not enough social workers or counselors. If you come in, let's say, with alcoholism, they probably can't help you. They just don't have the slot. And what you see happening, I may ask you for an appointment. I'm willing to be brave enough to say, I do need help. And they'll say, well, we can see you in 6 months. And you've had soldiers who killed themselves during that wait because they couldn't get seen at the time they needed to be seen. It's also just worth mentioning very briefly, where you're seeing a massive spike now in suicide is among part-time soldiers, people in the National Guard or the Army Reserve. These are people who may be a lawyer in real life, then were supposed to think that they would just do a weekend, a month in the Army, that'd be the end of it. Instead, they served a year in Iraq, a year in Afghanistan. If they're in the active military, there's a system. It may not work well, but there is a system. If you come back and you're from the Army National Guard, you go back to life as a lawyer, there's no system. No one who knows you would have any understanding of what you went through. So even as the war ends, unfortunately, the wounds, the repercussions, this will go on for a very, very long time.
Indeed. Well, Yochi, as we close, it seems to me that it's actually transcends what any particular bureaucracy can do, whether it's the Veterans Administration or the Armed Forces. I think we as a society here in America have to be cognizant of what is going on with the volunteer army and the terrible trauma that they suffer. What recommendations do you have for all of us here, all citizens, to grapple with this problem, this suicide epidemic? I mean, we all should feel responsible and be able to do something to alleviate this suffering.
It's very easy, and you see this in the United States now all the time. When a soldier is in the airport, people will applaud or thank them for their service, and you sort of feel good about yourself. But that's not what these soldiers need. What they need is a person who's willing to actually say to them, "How are you doing?" and listen, and not just say, "Hey, thank you for your service," and move on and have that be the end. The other thing, and this is a real risk a lot of military friends of mine have deep concern about, is if a narrative takes root that soldiers who come back from Iraq or Afghanistan are ticking time bombs, that one day they're just going to pick up a gun and shoot themselves or shoot up their office, they won't be able to find normal life. And if you're a listener and you meet a veteran who's applying for a job, you're being asked out by a veteran, don't look and think, there's some wound in him that I can't see, but when I see it, my life will end or change. Recognize these are good people, they are strong people, and they're people who deserve to be treated like any other.
The book is The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War. The author, Yochi Driesen. Well, Yochi, thank you so much for coming in, and congratulations once again on this tremendous and important book.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and joining me on the program was Maggie Quinn. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, The Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to PCUSA@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to The Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.